Hello and welcome everybody to a very special edition of Podcasting Them Softly. I'm Frank, and of course I'm joined by my co-host and BFF, Nick. How are you doing today?
What's going on, buddy? It's very exciting.
Yeah, I'm very excited for this. I get to do the intro, which is awesome.
Yep.
So we are very honored to be joined with visual effects master Ed Kramer. Ed spent 12 years working for Industrial Light and Magic and is now currently an instructor at the Art Institute of Colorado. Ed has an incredibly impressive resume as the senior technical director and sequence supervisor on 24 feature films, including Twister, The Lost World, Jurassic Park, The Mummy Returns, The Perfect Storm, Galaxy Quest, The Island, Harry Potter, The Chamber of Secrets, and he was a part of the Academy Award-winning team on Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. Now here it is. This is the greatest thing ever that's happened to me in my life. Ed was also part of the groundbreaking visual effects team that changed cinema forever with the use of digital effects and filming digitally with the three Star Wars prequels: Episode 1, The Phantom Menace; Episode 2, Attack of the Clones; and Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. And Ed was also a part of the team that created Columbia Pictures' Lady with the Torch logo. Welcome to the show, Ed. This is incredibly amazing to get to speak with you.
Well, thank you. It's an honor to be speaking with you guys as well on Podcasting Them Softly.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming on. I know Frank and I have been talking. We're both very excited, and I'm not going to block Frank at all from kicking off the show here because I know he's super pumped to get into Star Wars. So, Frank, take it away.
Yeah, I mean, anybody that listens to the show knows that I'm overly obsessed with Star Wars, and it's been my life's passion and stuff. So, I'm curious as to, I don't even know where to begin with this. So I suppose I'll ask you, what was it that you did on the prequels?
Well, okay. Well, those were three entirely different movies, as you're probably aware. So my job responsibilities on each one of those were different. Before I get into any talking about me, I always want to, make sure, and you did a great job of this in your intro of making sure that people heard this, but you're always part of a team. And it's always a collaborative endeavor. And the people, when I was at Industrial Light and Magic, and today and forever since the beginning of time, Industrial Light and Magic has had some of the most talented visual effects artists on the face of the planet. And just like you were saying, oh, it's such an honor to have me on the show. It was really an honor for me to be able to work with people like Dennis Muren and John Knoll. And there's so many. I mean, I could name about 10 visual effects supervisors at Industrial Light and Magic who are, the best visual effects supervisors on the planet. And so for me, it was an incredible honor to be able to work on these projects and to be an employee of that company for 12 years. And I should say also that I've been living in Denver since 2006, so I'm not a current employee of Industrial Light and Magic, but I maintain hopefully good relationship with everybody. I visited there a couple of years ago, and it was just a wonderful experience to see all those folks again. But these days I do spend more time with my family. And I have a job where, when you work in the movie business, the movie always has to come first. That's just like a given. And so now, if I need to be somewhere, if my daughter's in a concert at school, if my son's playing a baseball game, whatever, if I tell them I'm going to be there, now I actually can. When you work in movies, you can't do that. Okay, so that's kind of a long and short of where I am now, and my thank yous to Industrial Light and Magic for 12 amazing years there. You asked about what I did on the Star Wars movies. And on Episode 1, The Phantom Menace, I worked what I was at Industrial Light and Magic, what I was hired as, was a senior technical director. And basically that meant lighting and compositing on shots. So various films, I had various degrees of compositing. Sometimes I had compositors that were working with me on particular shows or on particular shots. And but I was pretty much always the person doing the lighting on the CGI elements in the shots. Now, Star Wars was always a really wonderful, and I'm sure still is, a wonderful mix of practical effects, CGI effects, green screen, you know, the entire gamut of the visual effects spectrum. And so on episode one, I mostly did lighting on shots involving a certain character with the initials JJB. I don't have anything to do with the creation of the character, but I put lights on him and made him look like he was there in the plate when obviously an actor wearing a funny suit with a very large head was actually there in the plate. Ahmed Best, of course, is the name of the actor. And so he was digitally removed. And when I received the plates, in other words, the footage that was actually shot, he had already been, the actor Ahmed Best had already been digitally removed from the plates. So there were compositors and rotoscope artists involved in actually removing the live action dude. And of course, what I then had to do was put the computer generated Jar Jar Binks in there and make sure that he was lit in the, that he looked like he was there when they shot the scene. In other words, if there's actors in the plate, you got to make the lighting on Jar Jar look like the lighting that's going on the actors, from direction, intensity, diffuse and specular. There's a lot of technical terms that CGI artists use, but basically it's the whole process of putting a computer generated character into a scene and making that character look like he was there when the plate was shot by the director. A lot of the things that people don't think about are things like shadows. You know, if a CGI character is walking into an environment and there's human characters, live action characters that are casting shadows, well, the CG character's got to cast shadows in exactly the same way. The shadows have to be in the right direction, with the same intensity, the same softness. And those are the things that, you know, visual effects supervisors who've been doing this kind of work forever notice immediately. And that's what was so great about working with all these, you know, wonderful visual effects supervisors, is that, you know, the eye that they had for detail was, you know, was a training ground for all of us to learn, you know, what, when you look at a scene, something that is not real, if something is making it not look real, you've got to actually figure out, well, what is it that's not making it look real, and how do I go about fixing that? How, what do I need to do to make it look better? So on episode one, I did a lot of the Jar Jar shots. On episode two, that was kind of one of the highlights of my career, because I was asked to be a look development technical director and actually supervise a couple of sequences on the film. So that was really a wonderful experience. I was working with visual effects supervisor Ben Snow, who's one of the best in the business. I was supervising the droid factory sequence, you know, where 3PO gets his head knocked off and the battle droid's head gets zapped on there. There's a big, you know, the encounter with the flying Geonosians on the conveyor belts, and everybody who's seen the movie knows what I'm talking about there.
Right.
The Geonosians are those bug aliens. And the scene, obviously, where Amidala is in the container that's about to be filled with molten metal, and the scenes where she and Anakin are running around on the conveyor belt and all the machines are stamping away at them, and so that was a really cool sequence to be able to supervise. And what supervising actually means for a sequence like that is working with a number of extraordinarily talented technical directors and making sure that all of their work was consistent, because you have different artists working on different shots, and they may all light their shot beautifully, but if those shots have to cut together, and one person has lit it from one side, and then the next person has lit it beautifully from the other side, when those shots get cut together, it looks like the lighting jumped around. So someone has to be in charge of making sure there's a consistency across all the shots. The light can't be too bright on one side of one character and then cut to a shot where the light is not that bright. So one of the things that I was doing was maintaining a consistency of lighting from one shot to the next. And also the sequence supervisor would develop techniques that all the artists on the sequence would use. And there were a number of people that worked on the techniques on the Star Wars shots. But, you know, whenever a lightsaber would hit one of the arms on the conveyor belt and cut it off, sparks would fly out. So somebody had to figure out, you know, well, what do those sparks look like? And how are we going to make all those sparks when things get chopped by lightsabers? So that sequence, and also on episode two, I was asked to supervise a number of shots in the end battle sequence. So that was really fun. And what's really cool is that I kept a lot of, you know, when you work, you keep notes, right? And so I still have all my notebooks from working on all these shots. And every now and then I'll be going through some of these notebooks and I'll see, wow, here's a page that actually has the comments that I got from the visual effects supervisor. And I know that those comments actually came to them from George himself, because George would work very closely. And most movies only have one visual effects supervisor but these movies had so many visual effects shots that it was always Dennis Muren and John Knoll and Ben Snow and Pablo Hellman, and there's so many effects supervisors at ILM that would have Scott Squires would have their own units during the making of a Star Wars movie, and George would work with those visual effects supervisors, and then those visual effects supervisors would come back to the sequence supervisors on their teams and let us know the changes that George requested on particular shots. So, you know, it's kind of cool to go back and look at this page of notes and realize, wow, that probably like came from George's brain, that comment right there. And then on episode three, I did a lot of work on the battle between Anakin and Obi-Wan on Mustafar, where they're on the collection arm, and that collection arm, you know, is splashed by lava, and the lava weakens it, and the arm collapses and floats away down the river of lava while they're having a lightsaber battle on the arm that's floating down the lava. I worked along with Peg Hunter on a number of those shots where they're doing the laser duel, floating down the lazy lava river. and actually what's very cool about that one in particular is on the DVD of episode three, they have a bonus feature. I'm trying to remember what it's called. Something like All in 1 Minute or something. It's got a title, something like that, where it talks about 1 minute of the film, which was this and the minute they chose to look at happened to be the sequence that I was working on. So they talked to some of the technical directors talking about how we created the lava, and they actually show a little picture of me floating around in space as part of that that bonus feature. So that's pretty cool. But it's a wonderful clip. It's probably about an hour dedicated to 1 minute of time in the movie, but it talks to all the different departments, the editorial department, the props, the everybody who did the green screens, and they talk to all the different groups of artists involved in making this 1 minute clip from this one movie, and that in itself was long enough for an hour long or so documentary.
Nick, jump in real quick while I process this.
Actually, I did have a question, Ed. you said something before. You said it's your job to figure out. You made a comment like the sparks come out when 3PO got messed up, right? And the sparks come flying out, and you have to figure out what they look like and how to make them. What does that mean to make them? I need to understand, because I don't get, like, computers to me is stuff that just like blow, it just way over my head, and I can only imagine the time and effort and energy and patience that must go into this stuff when you're sitting in front of a computer all day working on this type of stuff. So I'm curious to know what you mean by make the sparks.
Okay, well, fair question. And by the way, I'll have a little announcement a little bit later that you just reminded me about with this question. What I mean by making the sparks is when they're on those conveyor belts, those are not actual conveyor belts inside an actual droid factory. Those are CGI conveyor belts created inside a computer, and the actors are against green screen holding, sticks that are going to be turned into lightsabers. I don't think I'm revealing any secrets of the trade here. I think that there's plenty of videos you can track down on YouTube to verify that. So if they're hitting some robotic arms with those lightsabers, those robotic arms are not real, and neither are the lightsabers. They're just swinging a stick painted green in the air, and eventually it gets made to look like a lightsaber. And so if it has to hit something in the environment, then the thing that it's going to hit is something that is created digitally inside the computer. So we can't just set a fuse on it and load it with gunpowder and say, on the count of three, light the fuse and have it blow up. We have to tell the computer, well, how are you going to make something that looks like sparks? So it turns out that there's a really cool type of computer software specifically made for things like sparks. It's generically known as a particle system. And you can use particle systems. Particle systems were invented in the late 1980s, early 1990s. I remember the very first time I ever saw a particle system. I go to this conference every year called SIGGRAPH, and I remember a guy named Carl Sims had created a movie called Particle Dreams when he was working on the very first particle system renderer, and he created a waterfall. And I remember seeing that waterfall at SIGGRAPH and thinking, oh my God, I've never seen anything like that. There's millions of individual things all animating at once, and they're coming over a cliff and they're hitting rocks and bouncing off, and it looked like a waterfall. And, today when you look at that, you go, wow, that looks really old and primitive, and I could probably do something much better than that in 10 minutes on Maya sitting here in my office in the basement. But at the time when Carl Sims did it, you know, it was an amazing thing to see. And then later, a gentleman named Jim Hourihan created a particle system graphical interface that became part of a system at the time called Wavefront. And he was working for Santa Barbara Studios at the time, run by Jim Brower. And then the particle system that Jim Hourihan created eventually became the particle system that was used in the software called Maya, which is the what I actually teach today at school. But the particle system is for animating thousands or hundreds or thousands of things all at once, and those things are represented by particles, and it's relatively easy to make the particle system be attached to a CGI object like one of those robotic arms, and say at a certain point in time emit a bunch of particles, and I'm going to render those to make them look like they're hot and glowy and sparky, and but it's all synthetic. It's all a program inside the computer that a skilled artist is able to use to simulate things that we see in the real world. It's all a trick. It's all, you know, digital and invented, and it's based on code that someone wrote, and it's based on a user interface that someone wrote, and an artist is using that interface to adjust the intensity of the particles, the amount of glow, the direction that they're shooting out, the intensity at which they're shooting out, whether some of them are big, some of them are little. Particle systems are also used to make dust. So whenever you see, computer-generated dust and debris being kicked up by buildings that are destroyed by comets or earthquakes or, you know, monsters, particle systems are a big part of that. Another place where I used particle systems was in creating the scarabs for the Mummy movies. And so I controlled a whole bunch of little particles all moving around and then instanced onto each particle a little scarab, the geometry of a scarab that an animator had animated the legs of the scarab moving. And so by putting that scarab with the moving legs onto a particle and then telling the particles to move around in a random manner, each one moving on its own path, but individually all of them moving as a unit, and just giving them a few rules, like if you get too close to another particle, move away. And that way you don't have scarabs going through other scarabs. But just with a few little rules like that, we were able to make, you know, impeding hordes of scarabs in the Mummy movies with pretty much the same kind of software that we made sparks coming out of those droid arms on the conveyor belt.
How did you first get approached? Well, you already had been working for Industrial Light and Magic prior to the prequels.
Yeah, I was hired at Industrial Light and Magic to work on Jumanji. So that was the first film that I worked on at ILM. But you got to understand that by the time I was hired at Industrial Light and Magic in 1994, I had already been working in computer graphics for 15 years. So I started out doing computer graphics back in the very late 70s and early 1980s. So I've been doing computer graphics pretty much from the beginning of the time where there was computer graphics. So at the time that I sent my reel into Industrial Light and Magic for them to consider me, I had already been working in Hollywood for years. I had been working in New York for years. At the time, I was working in Atlanta at a company called Crawford Design Effects, And believe it or not, we had this world-class team in Atlanta, Georgia. Five of us eventually went on to work for Industrial Light and Magic from this place in Atlanta, Georgia. A number of us worked at ILM. One of us went on to help start Sony Imageworks. Another one went on to help start DreamWorks Studios. So it was a very seminal group of folks in Atlanta, Georgia in the early 90s. So by the time I sent a reel to ILM in 93 or 94, it was a pretty professional looking reel already. So, you know, I was hired in at a senior level at Industrial Light and Magic when I started working there. So I started on Jumanji.
I would love to ask a quick question about Jumanji because I went to school at Keene State in New Hampshire, and they shot some of the, you know, the town was shot there. In fact, the, you know, the Paris shoe thing, you know, that brick wall. Did you work on any of that where the animals are running through the town?
I worked on a couple of the stampede shots, but not any of the stampede shots where they're running through the town square. Those were done by Joel Aaron and Barbara Nellis, and probably two or three other technical directors that I can't remember off the bat. You know, what was interesting about those days back then in the early 90s was computer graphics was still new. And this is one of the points that I'm constantly making to my students about how computer graphics has been constantly evolving over time. You know, they get in on a computer graphics system right now, and it's got all these things that you can do, and they don't realize, well, you couldn't do that 8 years ago. You couldn't use that feature. You know, 12 years ago, nobody was doing that. You know, 3 years ago, you couldn't do that. So on Jumanji, for those sequences that you're talking about from New Hampshire, they made a car that was rigged to implode as if an elephant were walking over it. These days, you know, we would probably say, you know, just leave that whole area blank. We'll put the car in. Don't worry. We'll make the car look great. We'll put the elephant in. We'll put, you know, whatever you need. But in those days, the early 90s to late 90s, which was just such a wonderful period to have been working there, we didn't have the confidence in CGI because a lot of the things that we take for granted now didn't even exist back then. And so they had to make a car that was rigged so that the top would pull down when the front leg of the – I'm sure there were meetings that went on to discuss where the elephant's feet would go and what would be the timing so that they could rig the car to self-destruct. And then after we would get the footage, we would put the elephant in. But by the time we would get the footage then, well, we would see, well, this thing pulls down first, then this thing pulls down, then this thing pulls down, and the windshield breaks. And so we would be able to animate the elephant's feet landing in the right spot with the right timing, because they had worked all that stuff out on, you know, when they were doing the shoot, so that they could make the rigged car seem to be crushed by an elephant, even though there was no elephant. And, you know, if you watch that plate, and it looks like there's an invisible elephant crushing the car.
Now, are you a fan of that? Are you a fan of that process more, the combination of live action, you know, physical effects combined with the computer stuff, as opposed to full on computer stuff?
Well, it has nothing to do with whether you're a fan or not. What it actually has to do with is how much is that going to cost? And if it's going to cost more to do it fully CGI, then they'll do it with practical. If it's going to cost more to do it with practical, then they'll do it with CGI. So, you know, the thing that drives it is, you know, has nothing to do with how much you like the look of one thing or another, it has to do with, well, what's the budget and which is the most cost-effective option to get this done. So at the time that car was done, that was the only option, because they couldn't take the chance that, you know, we would make the car and it wouldn't look photoreal. Now, the same thing happened with a shot that I did work on Jumanji. If you remember, there's a shot where that police car, because the police car becomes a major character in that movie, and it keeps getting more and more banged up and shot up and beat up. And then finally, a vine comes out of the woods, wraps around the car, and just drags it off into the woods. And that's the death of the police car, right? You guys remember that, right?
Yep.
So, that was a shot that I was fortunate enough to be asked to be the technical director on. And as that car, the vine comes out of the woods, and it's a CGI vine, so that we can control how it moves and how it goes through the car. It wraps around the car, and then it pulls the car up on edge and then pulls it into the woods, and it goes through these trees, and the trees bend it, and so it's kind of a shell of a car at the time it gets dragged off. The car, as it's being flipped up, as it's flipping up onto its side, that is the real that is the real police car, not a CGI car. As soon as the car flips up onto its side, we cut on one frame. We do a cut from the real car to the CGI car. You do not see that transition because we worked for a long time. Jeff Campbell was the modeler, and he worked amazingly hard, and I was capturing textures from the plates themselves and mapping it onto Jeff's model, and we eventually got it so that the car changes from a real car to a CGI car on one frame, and you do not see that transition. It's a little bit after that transition that it kind of hits the trees and reacts. But the transition from the real car to the CGI car is seamless.
The Star Wars prequels and, you know, Jumanji, Galaxy Quest, a lot of the films that you have worked on, I will rewatch them to this day. And then I will see something contemporary that uses CGI, and I notice a huge breakdown. I don't know, right? I mean, do you feel that way too, Nick? Like with certain, the majority of CGI films, it's just like, or I should say films that overly use CGI.
Oh, I completely agree. We've talked about this any number of times.
Yeah, we've talked about it.
And I even want to reference the stuff in Twister, because here's a movie that's going to be 20 years old next year. And I'm sorry, but that stuff still looks real. And I definitely feel that over the last 5, 6, 7 years, the overall quality of CGI, especially in CGI-dominated movies, I feel like the quality has come down considerably. And I don't know what that is or what the reason is for it. I mean, you look at some of the stuff done in the mid-90s, and it still holds up really well. And one of the things actually I wanted to ask you about, and it sort of gets to that, you know, there's two movies that on your roster, I feel, that are just like insane in terms of the photoreal quality of the CGI. And, you know, The Island is one, and the work done on Dead Man's Chest is the other, the face of Davy Jones is just spectacular. And that stuff that's 10 years old. And in my head, it looks better than the stuff that's coming out in half of the summer blockbusters from this year.
Okay, well, I've got about 5 or 6 answers to about 5 or 6 questions that just got raised. I do want to I want to shout out to a guy I have not met, a guy named Pierre Grage, G-R-A-G-E. He's written a fantastic book called Inside VFX, An Insider's View into the Visual Effects and Film Business. And Pierre Grage is a CGI artist. He worked at Industrial Light and Magic in Singapore. He's also worked at a number of shops in Europe and around the world. But his background was as a student of economics. And so he's written a book about the changes that have taken place in the CGI industry over the last 10 years. I was very fortunate. I got out of the visual effects world in 2006. I kind of extracted myself from that world and plopped myself down in a much less stressful environment and kind of disengaged from that world for a number of years. But Pierre's book will answer a lot of the questions that you've raised about the changes that have taken place in the CGI world in the last decade. There's a number of points that I could summarize. One, the software used to be nowhere near as powerful or as ubiquitous as it is now. It used to be that particular facilities had developed software in-house to do amazing effects. When when we worked on The Perfect Storm at Industrial Light and Magic, people like Doug Smythe and many others wrote some amazing shaders to allow us to do photorealistic looking oceans. Well, now anyone can open Maya and apply an ocean shader to a polygon and learn how to use the ocean shader that just comes bundled in Maya. Anyone, you know, when we did Jumanji, it was, believe it or not, the first time anyone had ever seen a computer-generated creature covered in fur. We did that for the monkeys,
yeah,
and also
right.
for the mane of the lion. Carl Frederick was involved in the look development of the lion. I was doing a lot of the look development work for the monkeys, along with Doug Smythe and Christoph Ehry. And at the time, no one else could do that. Now you open up Maya, you click on the model you made of a monkey, and you click on add fur, and it asks you, well, what kind of fur do you want? And, you know, it gives you options like, you know, buffalo fur or wet poodle fur. You know, there's what has happened with the software is it has become so much less technical to understand in order to use it. And therefore, you've got a lot more artists who are capable of doing a lot of things that it used to be only very specialized artists could do. That's one thing. Then the computer hardware has come way down in cost. So rendering, which used to be a major issue, now you can outsource rendering. So there's so many changes that have taken place, plus what has happened in the film world. And anyone who works in this industry knows the word that I'm about to use is a very bad word. It's a word called incentives. And what has happened is that tax incentives that certain countries are allowed to offer have basically moved the industry, which used to be a thriving industry inside the United States. And now there's very little actual production going on at the level of these blockbuster movies. You know, a great deal of that work has moved to India and China and Singapore and Malaysia and, you know, Canada, of course, and England. And there's a lot of other countries worldwide. But unfortunately, the incentives in the United States have kind of not kept up with what's going on in other countries. And a lot of the work has, and the employees have gotten sucked into other countries. I still have, very, very good dear friends, Barry Dempsey, Jim Moorhead, people who are still working in this industry. And, you know, Barry has spent a lot of time living in England, living in Vancouver, bouncing around from one project to the next project to the next project. And he's one of the top people in the industry. So, you know, it has become less of a full-time job with one company and more of a project-based field where a lot of international workers are being used, and a lot of top artists have left, have retired or moved on to other things like myself. Many people are now in education because it's no longer an industry that sustains people who have mortgages and children who need stability. And it has become much more of a transient industry. And so there's been a lot of changes that have taken place that account for not only some of the change in quality that you see, and I'm not dissing any, you know, country in particular, but you know.
But it's noticeable. I mean, it's noticeable. I mean, like, I sort of disengage. I sort of just become removed from some of these recent CGI movies because I'm so completely aware of the fact that I'm looking at something artificial and it means nothing and there is no weight. And one of the things, like the water in Perfect Storm, great example. One of the first times I can actively remember being in a movie theater and looking at fake water and saying to myself, damn, they got water right. And, you know, I look at your credits and a lot of the stuff that you've had a chance to work, that you had a chance to work on, they really do feel like movies that used CGI in a really, really smart way and an effective way. And I have to bring it up just because I've long been a fan of The Island. I think that it's an underrated movie overall, but the CGI in that movie, especially during that jet bike thing, that is some of the craziest stuff that I've ever seen. And some of it is so photoreal. And I watched the sequence earlier today twice, and I've seen that sequence so many times with the train wheels, and I don't get how any of that was done. And it looks so real. And what I have to ask, what on the island did you get a chance to work on?
Well, I actually worked on one of those speeder shots that you're talking about. Oh. And if you watch my demo reel, my demo reel is on Vimeo for anyone who wants to watch it. Just type in
Ed, we will post that. Ed Framer. We'll post that on our page.
And there's a shot in that jet bike sequence. It's right after they jump on the bike. And she says to him, how does this work? I don't know. And then they cut from a medium close up to essentially like as wide of a shot as you were going to get. And it's the bike basically blasting off, and it looks unbelievable. And I've said to myself repeatedly, that shot had to have cost millions of dollars. Like there's no way that was real. I don't know if you know the shot I'm talking about. It's literally right when that bike blasts off for the first time, truly. And I'm just tell me anything you can about it. I love it.
Well, I didn't work on that shot, so I can't tell you a damn thing about it.
but anything in general, I don't care what it is. I've long been enamored with the visual style of that movie, and I just thought it looked just unbelievable.
One, you know, it was a Michael Bay film, right?
Of course. And Mauro Fior is no slouch either.
Yep. And I got to meet Mauro. He came out to Denver a few years ago, and I got to hang out with him for a day. That was pretty cool. You know, of course, that he went on to do Avatar.
Oh, yeah. He's phenomenal. He's one of my favorite modern cinematographers. He has been for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, the visual effects, you know, some of the, it was done at Industrial Light and Magic, a great deal of it. Eric Brevig, B-R-E-V-I-G, was the visual effects supervisor. And yeah. Eric's done a number of things. He did Journey to the Center of the Earth in 3D. He did the Yogi Bear movie. Chris Townsend was Oh no, Chris worked with Eric on. Well, Chris is another story altogether. But you know, we had so many talented people working on the visual effects. I worked with Doug Sutton and you know, I'm looking right now. I called it up on IMDb and I'm looking through this list of the people that worked on that movie. And you know, there's just some of the most some of the best visual effects supervisors and CGI artists and rotoscopers, you know, down to, you know, every single person that worked on that movie was great. But I can't tell you any more of the specifics about the particular shot that you're talking about.
Or just how much of the bike, like, was any of that bike, I mean, I know when they jump on it, there's a couple of shots that had to have been practical, but, you know, in any portion of that train wheel sequence or any of that bit, you know, what was it like working on it and working with presumably, you know, live action footage that looked as great as it did, and then you're going in there and, you know, doing your magic? I just don't understand the sequence, how it was put together. I continually watch it and I say to myself, it's just one of the best sequences of action that Bay's ever done.
Well, what I'm going to have to do is talk about that sequence then in the book that I'm about to write. Because I am about to write a book and I'm going to highlight particular sequences from particular movies and talk to a number of the artists themselves. You know, when you see these making of movies or bonus features on DVDs, usually the only person that they talk to would be the person at the top of the visual effects food chain. And what I want to do is focus on particular sequences and talk to a number of the actual artists who were involved in making that sequence happen. Because on that particular sequence, there had to be, and I'm not sure who these particular artists are. I mean, I've got a list of people in front of me, and but I don't remember who actually modeled the bike, you know, the speeder bikes that we're talking about. But there would be someone who was in charge of the green screen capture for the live action, you know, the faces and the bodies of Ewan McGregor. And I also got to work on some digital double work. So I got to build a digital Ewan McGregor and a digital Scarlett Johansson. And that was a lot of fun. In fact, I've done a number of digital doubles in Van Helsing. I got to create a digital double of Hugh Jackman. So a lot of the, you know, those shots, some of them were filmed with the real actors on green screen, and then they're riding some kind of, you know, bike made out of plywood. Where the angles look relatively the same as the angles of the bike that they're going to be riding, and the plywood's painted green. So their feet are out at the right angles and that kind of stuff. But then the CGI speeder is put in digitally. The actor is removed from the green screen footage, composited on top of the speeder. The speeder is lit with CGI lights to make it look like it was in the real environment. And the actor is composited on. CGI shadows are created to make, you know, if they hover near something, of course, they've got to cast a shadow. So there's a lot of things, all those things that the wheels that fell off of the car that, you know, those were all CGI. So that we could control the animation of them, and we could use dynamics to calculate the physics properties of those guys to make them roll correctly down the street.
So all the train wheels were CGI.
I'm not promising that because I wasn't that involved with those particular shots, but it seems to me that I recall those shots being in dailies. And they were changing the animation on those guys falling off the truck. I'm pretty sure I remember that, but I'm not 100% for certain. I wasn't involved in those particular shots. I was just seeing them every now and then when they would come up
and
in daily.
How much harder is it to do this sort of photoreal stuff when the action is taking place during the day as opposed to the night?
Well, daylight looks like daylight, nighttime looks like nighttime, and if you know how to light scenes, it shouldn't really matter to you which one you're doing. You're making it look like what it needs to look like. So it's not like daytime is hard and nighttime is easy. It's not like nighttime is hard and daylight is easy. It's what you're matching is what's going on in the plate. You pay attention to the direction of the light. There's always someone on set taking notes and photographs. And then there's also in the new way of doing computer graphics, there's a system known as image-based lighting, where what you're doing is lighting the scene based on information that you captured on set. So there's always somebody on set with a chrome sphere who's being filmed with a chrome sphere, which reflects all the lights that are in the environment. So you get a really good representation of where the lights are and their relative intensities to each other. And then that same person will also use an 18% gray sphere so that you can see kind of the diffuse component of those lights without the reflection, without the specular highlights. And using those two images that are captured from somebody just holding a sphere in the set, you can pretty much these days get about 90% of the way to lighting your shot on your first take, because it's all based on using the light that was captured on set at the time that they were shooting and then mapping that back into the CGI environment. That was a huge change that took place in the computer graphics industry, within the last 10 actually, right around the turn of the decade, right around the year 2000, the use of image-based lighting and image-based modeling to capture geometry and map it back onto itself. And now we have LiDAR, which is kind of like a GPS type of device for actually capturing the geometry in the set, as well as the textures that get mapped back onto the geometry. There's a lot of advances that have taken place in the field of computer graphics, all to make it easier. And a lot of this has also contributed to the phenomenon that you're talking about, because less and less skilled people are required in the making of these movies anymore. There's more and more opportunity to use junior level and not as experienced artists, because a lot of this software and hardware and ability to capture imagery on set has taken a lot of the guesswork and the what used to be the artistry of the scenes and made it into kind of like just a production line type of task, and that's where a lot of the problem has the CGI-ing of the industry has really taken place. But it used to be not that many people who could do these kinds of things, and therefore they had to do them very well for it to be convincing. And times have changed.
Yeah. I'll say, with a few exclusions of some big films that I think the CGI is excellent in, I'm going to post your demo reel for when we post our chat with you. I do want to ask you on it, you have that image of Qui-Gon Jinn, Liam Neeson from Episode 1 holding the lightsaber, like before the final duel.
Well, what's really funny about that, the reason that is on my reel is because I created the pixels in the background behind him. And that took that one shot, my work on that one shot was probably about maybe a day at the most.
Wow.
I can't remember right now. Oh gosh, this is awful. I can't remember who the compositor was on that shot. So the compositor did most of that shot, but that was shot with Liam Neeson against green screen, and we had to put him into an environment. So there were a number of shots in that sequence that I was just creating the digital backgrounds behind the characters that put them in the environments that they needed to be. So, you know, if you take out Liam Neeson and his lightsaber, all the pixels that are left are the pixels that I was responsible for.
Yeah, but he still needs a background, and I think that's, for me, that's the most iconic shot for episode one.
You know, sometimes a shot that just looks like, this is just going to be easy. Let me, you know, I'll just knock that out in a couple of hours. And it turns out to be one of the iconic shots from the movie. And that's pretty much how that was. I'm sure I spent no more than a day doing that shot. And I was probably working on that shot and one or two others from that same sequence in that one day. It turned out that was one of the iconic shots from the movie. So that was very fortunate. Another thing that I was just incredibly lucky to do, they were not difficult shots at all, but, at the very end of episode three, when Obi-Wan is delivering the baby Luke to Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru on Tatooine, he comes in on this kind of camel looking creature, which is called an Eopi. And I was fortunate enough to have done the lighting and the lighting and some of the compositing work on those shots that actually ended the entire trilogy. Because at the time we didn't know episodes 7, 8, and 9 were in the works. You know, I mean, most of us assumed that no matter what was said, they probably would eventually get made. But, you know, at the time, the word on the street was that they wouldn't, and this was the end of the whole trilogy. So these few shots that I got to light the Eopi from ended up being the last shots in the entire Star Wars trilogy up until that point. So that was really cool. It was just about a week or so of my time there, but they ended up being the iconic shots that ended the entire Star Wars second trilogy. So, you never know when a little bit of work is going to become, you know, some kind of archetypal memory in the public mind's eye.
That's very cool. Yeah, that is so cool. I want to be mindful of the time with you. But the last thing I want to ask you about is the rock monster in Galaxy Quest.
I was wondering when we were going to get to my rock monster.
Because Galaxy Quest is a great film. It is so good, and the rock monster scene is one of my favorite moments of that movie.
Yeah, big fan of Galaxy Quest.
I didn't want to hog the whole time talking gushing about Star Wars since I'm such a fanboy. But yeah, I know that you did the rock monster from our friend Tim, who writes for us on Podcast Them Softly, was the one who hooked us up with you. So we're very grateful for him, and he had mentioned that you did a lot of work on the rock monster. So I thought that was very cool, and I had to ask you about that.
Okay, well, usually the question that I get where the rock monster comes up is, what was the favorite movie that you ever worked on? that's a big question when I do these talks, and by far the most favorite, my personal favorite movie, even if I hadn't worked on it, I mean, Galaxy Quest would still be one of my all-time favorite movies. I love that movie. So what an honor to look back and remember you know, that I had been asked to supervise the Rock Monster on that movie. And I worked with an incredible team of people, as always. Ben Snow was the visual effects supervisor on that movie. And the director, Dean Pariseau, was so amazing, because a lot of times you read a script and it'll be laugh out loud funny, and then you see it up on the screen and somehow the director has directed a lot of the humor out of the movie. That happened with a few movies that I worked on. I won't name names. But with Galaxy Quest, I remember reading the script and chuckling. It wasn't a hilarious script, but Dean Pariseau directed the humor into that movie, and the actors that played the Thermians were so amazing. And so that movie was just so funny because of the performances and because of the directing, and because you really felt for those characters, even though they were, you know, silly cartoon science fiction characters, you really felt for them. The process of creating the Rock Monster, first, there are so many things that a sequence supervisor has to do. One of the things that I had to do was to figure out how we were going to light this Rock Monster. And so, boy, I'm getting a lot of feedback here. Are you guys hearing that?
A little bit. I don't know if it has to do with the snowstorm that's going over us.
Ah, maybe so.
With the a bad bandwidth internet connection, but yeah, go ahead, continue.
Okay.
I'll do my best to edit most of it out.
Okay. So the Rock Monster team was great. And what we did, Ben and I worked out, you know, what we wanted from the lighting on the Rock Monster, and we worked with a lot of the plates that were shot in Goblin Valley, Utah, which is only about 6 hours from where I live here in Denver. So it's really cool. I took my family to visit Goblin Valley a couple of summers ago, and so we were walking where the Rock Monster was walking. But not only did I have to deal with the lighting, but what I also needed to do was create some code. We talked earlier about particle systems. I used Jim Houlihan's particle system in order to make, when the rocks hit each other in the Rock Monster, dust and debris and little particles of sand were all emitted. And those particles were emitted based on calculating the intensity at which those rocks bumped and hit each other, the velocity vector where two rocks would hit, so that the dust and debris would come out in the right direction. And the harder they hit, the more dust and debris got emitted. And I worked with Dan Goldman to get a lot of that code in great shape. And then all of the technical directors just basically got their shot. They ran that code, and like magic, there was dust and debris coming out of the Rock Monster at all the right times from all the right places. You'll see a little bit of that in my demo reel. I've got a couple of behind the scenes shots in there of the dust and debris from the Rock Monster. And then there were also things like when the Rock Monster would walk, his feet, his legs would have to crunch the ground underneath him where he was walking. So I had to work out a technique using rigid body dynamics to break up the ground underneath his feet. And I had some wonderful technical directors working on those shots. Hilmar Koch was one of the main technical directors, Aaron Bonar. I had Max Rocchetti. There's some wonderful, wonderful TDs that lit particular shots. And the Rock Monster sequence actually went on a lot longer in the original script. In fact, in the original script, there were two Rock Monsters They think they've defeated the one rock monster, and then he comes back bigger and badder than before. A lot of that got cut back, but originally we did develop two different rock monsters, one the one that you see, and another one that was even bigger and badder. So we did final a couple of shots with that, but then the sequence got changed. There were a lot of issues because they were shooting all day at the Goblin Valley site, and in the morning, the sun is coming from one direction. In the afternoon, the sun is coming from another direction. So we had to really work hard on those shots to edit the sequence so that we maintained a continuity of lighting based on the backgrounds. There were some backgrounds we had to flip left to right. So these are the things that happened behind the scenes that no one knows about, no one sees. And then there was, you know, there was also the shoot with Tim Allen where he had to take his shirt off and he was on a harness. And there's an episode of, I think it's the show called Movie Magic. Gosh, I can't remember which show it was, but it was all about the filming of the practical effects for that sequence as well. So you could probably track that down on YouTube somewhere. But it was just a ton of fun to work on. And at the end of the shoot, the director, Dean Pariseau, actually came to Industrial Light and Magic and thanked us all personally for the work that we had done on that shot. So that was really cool to have the director come up and pay us a visit and thank us personally. He was just a fantastic guy to work with.
The Rock Monster. God, that movie's just so great on so many different levels. Tim Allen's great. Alan Rickman, Sigourney Weaver. The special effects are amazing.
Sam Rockwell steals it.
Sam Rockwell
is by far my favorite character in the movie. Don't you guys ever watch the show? Yeah.
So funny. It's one of my parents' absolute favorite films of all time, and I've been a fan for a while, and you're totally right about Dean Pariseau. He's such a great comedic director, and like you said, you know, brought comedy to the film as opposed to taking it out.
Yep, and the actors who played the Thermian characters were great, and also I'm blanking on his name, Monk.
Tony Shalhoub.
Tony Shalhoub was fantastic. You know, what a great cast, and a lot of them before, you know, that was Alan Rickman before Snape.
Yeah.
You know, so it was just a tremendous cast, and, you know, by grab Thar's hammer. There's so many quotable lines from that movie. I love that movie to pieces, and like I say, even if I had had nothing to do with it, it would still be one of my favorite movies of all time. So if we're about to go here, I do want to let people know, I just putting in a plug, I am right now working on the book Proposal, but my book is going to be, it's tentatively titled The Wizards of Hollywood, and it's true stories revealed from the artists who invented computer graphics. And I'm going to be looking at movies from throughout the history of computer-generated effects, and I'm going to be talking about the artists that worked on particular shots and highlighting particular wizards from throughout history. And the book is going to be in their own words. I'm interviewing people, and if anybody is interested and wants to stay. On my list and be the first to know about the book, if you text the word wizard to 555-888, text the word wizard to 555-888, and you'll be put on my mailing list. You'll be the first to know about my book and any news having to do with that book. So there's my little plug for my current project, and I appreciate you guys letting me do that.
Yeah, I'm texting that number right now. It's 555-888.
And text the word wizard.
All right, we're doing it. Live on our podcast.
Live on the podcast, I've got a new fan.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's fantastic. All right, I got instantly back. Awesome. Yeah, when that book comes out, and I'm sure we'll still be podcasting, I know we will be, we'll plug that for sure, and we'll put that on our site and our Facebook page and social media and everything. So very much looking forward to that. That sounds awesome.
Well, Frank, Dick, thank you so much for this opportunity to talk to your viewers, and thank you guys for listening, and get on my mailing list, and I'll let you know when that book is coming.
Sounds awesome. Sounds like a really cool project. Good luck, and thank you very much for coming on and chatting with us. It's really cool.
My pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so very much, Ed. This was incredible. Anytime you want to come back on, maybe we'll do an episode about Galaxy Quest in the future, and we'd love to have you on to talk about the film with us.
Sounds great.
From a fanboy analytical standpoint. So this has been wild, man. This is awesome. So thank you very much again for coming on and bearing with us through the winter storm that's going through the Midwest.
No problem. I think I'll go out and sled tomorrow.
Awesome. Great. Thank you again.
Bye-bye.